About a year and a half ago, I made the personal decision to stop drinking. Now, before I share my story, this isn't hard. I don't want y'all on the edge of your seats. It's a very boring story. I read a book called Soberful by Veronica Vallis, and she's a recovery coach and stuff like that, and I started doing ministry among 12-step folks. And she made a very convincing case about why my life would be better without alcohol. I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. So that's the story. So little did I know, though, that this decision would bother other people, right? The majority of, I don't know if you've ever been in seminary. Well, it's this church, but I don't know, like, every single outing, it seems, with seminary, Christian folks, or professors, it always seems to be at a bar, right? And for whatever reason, I've noticed, and this isn't, I'm not shaming, we don't judge, we don't shame here. For some reason, I've noticed it's always evangelicals who especially want to go up to the bars and who especially get stressed out that I'm not drinking, right? It's the exact same conversation over and over where I say, no, I'm not an alcoholic, or no, I don't care if you drink, or this is a choice for me. And every time someone invites me to a bar, I have to charge up more than normal for these conversations. But the replies are usually something like this. This is the one cool thing we can do. What gives? Well, for you to do. Anyway, but it struck me as so odd when I started this, that this is what made people uncomfortable. Because they assume I'm miserable without alcohol. And I think that's really an interesting statement on where we're at culturally. For instance, when you look at ads on television, every happy moment is accompanied by some kind of beer or some kind of wine. I'm probably going to totally butcher this phrasing, but there's a mommy drinking culture now where, you know, it's normal for moms to have, like, wine to cope with stress, and it's, like, advertised as a great thing, but it's necessary. But the more I have these conversations, the more it's kind of revealed. Often people can't imagine these social outings without some kind of alcohol involved or some kind of deep conversation. So when I hear or read passages like this, I think back to my interactions at bars with fellow believers, to bewildered folks trying to figure out why I won't have a drink because they think without it I'm miserable. But in the same way, when we Western Christians often make the mistake that the Jews are somehow miserable in this text for keeping their own way and keeping what's good for them. But from the Jewish perspective, their way of life is freeing. In the Middle Ages, when the bubonic plague was ravaging Europe, Christian communities looked at some surviving Jewish communities and started assuming they were the main source of the plague. In reality, what kept a lot of Jewish communities safe was the hygiene that came with keeping Torah. If they didn't follow those laws, they would have been just as affected. But for them, since Torah is liberating, it's a way of life that's important and sacred. I could go, this is a sermon itself, but we need to be really careful about reading too much into text about the Jewish way of life, because for a lot of these folks, this is what kept them surviving under occupation. They weren't necessarily miserable. It's a way they felt close to God and a cultural connection to one another. Theologically and socially, don't be like the people at the bar making a big deal about the one guy who doesn't drink. So for more great information about this, read Amy J. Levine and Daniel Boyerin, if you're interested. They're both Jewish scholars who specialize in explaining to Christians what Judaism is about. So this leads to my first point, though, which is that the church is a community of people of different backgrounds and cultures, and the worst possible thing we can do is make assumptions about one another. Some of us are ex-evangelical. Some of us still consider ourselves evangelical. Some of us grew up Mennonites. Some of us converted into the faith entirely. Some of us are still questioning. It's important to note in this passage, too, that Paul never stopped considering himself a Pharisee. So he was bringing in Jewish culture alongside his attendance and his leadership. What's different now for him, and this is what he's arguing for all of us, is that we all find common liberation in Christ. He ate with Gentiles to minister to them, but he never turned his back on his cultural background while doing so. In fact, he saw his culture as a gift. In fact, he doesn't really condemn people at all for keeping those food laws if it brings them closer to God. What he does condemn are the judgmental assumptions of others that he is somehow less in touch with God because of his ministry among Gentiles to meet them where they're at. Assumptions ran abound in the passage we just read. Cephas felt cultural pressure to join the folks who kept Torah and preached that everyone needs to do it, even though he personally didn't agree with it or live a consistent life, it seems. Paul points to Christ and shows no matter what our cultural assumptions are.
Oh, boy. Give me a second.
You're on the edge of your seat, I bet. That was a first. Okay. Paul points to Christ and says, no matter what our cultural differences are, no matter what our personal spiritual practices are, there are many ways to worship God within community. That through grace, we become community with these cultural differences, with the baggage we carry, with all our hurts, with all our wounds. Something I love about being in recovery circles is that there are some really great acronyms for God. My favorite one that stands for God is a group of drunks. Because in 12-step culture, we need each other, and there's a mutual understanding that we're there to offer support. There's inherent spirituality in that. The church is meant to be the same way. Whether you realize it or not, when you come to church, you are essentially admitting that you can't do life on your own. And that's great. You're saying, I need community, I need God, and I need a solid potluck. Church is supposed to be like that. It wasn't meant to be so big we can't find community with one another. It wasn't meant to be so strict doctrinally that we couldn't find ways to be community. It was meant to be small enough to know each other, simple enough to follow together, and to grow alongside one another, and to see how God works in the world. Because ultimately, what brings us together is that we all want to follow Jesus. This is an intentional way that Lombard Mennonite Church is a family together. In our yearly covenant, we affirm that there'll be differences in interpretation of scriptures among each other, but we're centered on Christ in all that we do. We're all bringing personal different ethics to the table, and we're making covenants with one another to grow in this Anabaptist way of life. This is different from many other models that rely on doctrine. This leads me to my second point, is that it's possible to know all the intricacies of the Bible, all the theology in the world, and yet miss Jesus entirely by the way you live and act. The early Anabaptist church recognized this. Hans Denk famously said, and this is a more modernized paraphrase, no one could truly know Christ unless they follow him in life. Now, this is very difficult to do. Even in community, imagine more so on your own. In many theological circles who are more fundamentalists, you'll often meet people who want to take the Bible literally without doing too much study or diving into the cultural context. But when Jesus' words come up about wealth, power, forsaking the world, all the uncomfy stuff that Anabaptists come to love, it's suddenly metaphorical. It's so odd because they're using pieces of the Bible to disagree with Jesus, right? And that's how you can miss the point of Jesus entirely, when you're so caught up in the religiosity of it and the feeling right that you miss the point entirely. During the early years of slavery in the United States, slave owners wanted to convert the slaves they owned, but they also didn't want to spark rebellion in the slave population or, God forbid, help them think they're equal, right? So what they did was they cut out portions of scriptures that had nothing to do with social justice. I got a copy of it right here. So if you want to check it out after the service, you can. It's kind of a sad one. But they cut out portions of scriptures that had anything to do with social justice, and what ended up happening was that they cut out 90% of the Old Testament and 50% of the New Testament. This is how much the scriptures preach equality. There's enough to say a prayer to become a Christian, but not much else in this book. So I would argue in a way that this Bible is very representative of where our mainstream theology has become. Just enough to access God, but not each other. It's common to cut out portions of scriptures related to social justice, to care for the poor, to be in community, to non-judgmentalism, and end up with a God that only cares about your internal destination and that you cross the right I's and dot the, or cross the right I's, dot the right I's and cross the right T's. I would argue that this is the way that this phenomenon is fairly new. Because when you look at every ancient religious and spiritual tradition, they always highlight the importance of community. The oldest structure we have archaeologically is actually a spiritual worship ground around the Middle East, where indigenous groups gathered together to worship God as they understood him. There is a deep awareness of the intrinsic connection between our neighbor and God and the natural world in these religions. So in the grand scheme of human history, the trajectory was always to point towards God and community. So it's a very new phenomenon for folks to think they can find God outside of community, outside of loving, healthy relationships. And in the church, we hopefully come to the understanding that we are here to grow together and bear witness to each other's lives. Because that's the point of Christianity. We never stop growing. There's always a new chance for repentance. There's always next steps. God never gives up on us. He's always offering us second, third, fourth, and fifth chances. But if we use the Bible to isolate ourselves from each other, if we use conflict as an excuse to run away from community, if we use someone else's views as an excuse to cut off relationships, if we use God to make horrible judgments about other people, then we're missing a key point of the gospel, which is that redemption and resurrection is freely given to all who seek it. And you know, there's always those situations where drifting away from community and church is right. There's hurt with church, but there's also some valid institutional mistrust. If you're a minority of some sort, religious, sexual, racial, whatever, there is very real history of the American church doing injustice. For that, I totally understand. But I encourage you to continue to find safe ways of spiritual community. In this moment of time, it's countercultural to let ourselves be known and loved for who we are and not who we should be. This kind of acceptance is subversive in our world because our love doesn't have a condition on it. Our love is based on the grace and beauty of Christ. In this moment of the early church with Paul and Cephas, this wasn't an excuse for Paul to write off church altogether. It wasn't an excuse to even shun Cephas' ministry. It was a chance for a correction to the course, to allow room for all to come into the church. Because of this conflict and because of this Torah-keeping restriction being lifted, the early church was known for being radically inclusive, a reputation I'd like to reclaim. In the first few centuries, some scholars speculate that the majority of church attenders were women and children, people who were otherwise shunned in society. This could have only happened because people in community learned how to disagree and learned how to correct the course. It's always amazing, and speaking from behind the pulpit as somebody who regularly interacts with the recovery community, it's always amazing how the strongest, most interesting leaders that emerge are always the misfits, usually, who at first didn't have it together. I'm continually proven wrong on my assumptions about people, because when people recognize God's work in their lives, they are capable of amazing growth. And that's one of the benefits of community. When you call yourself a Christian, you are declaring you believe in a redemption like that, that change can happen in someone's life for the better, and that you're willing to enter into community with them. But you first need to take the risk of being known and loved yourself. You need to move beyond hyper-individualism to see the beauty of God's hand at work. We need to take the scary step of emotional openness. And let me tell you, as someone who's learned this lesson over time, There is nothing more freeing than having permission to be your full, messy self in community. And if you're here today as a visitor, I want you to feel encouraged that there is a place for you here too, no matter where you come from or where you believe. And if you don't find your place here, I encourage you to find a healthy community and church that loves you. Because none of us were meant to journey alone. And growth and change that are possible for you is absolutely beautiful, no matter who you are. I hope you take the invitation to be known today, both by God and your neighbor. It's never too late to say yes to that party.